try to be very visible in the community and being part of parades or whatever, but
planting trees,
doing whatever we need to take to be a part of the community, wearing our t-shirts and just showing up at all kinds of stuff. So, but that is so important that community, we stay connected to the community. That's why, so we begin to organize, we have a face in the community, even with the faith-based people. I mean, just don't want to leave them out, because that's a congregated group of people once a week. So all I'm just saying, you're right about especially connecting with the community.
Mm-hmm. So, Sister Naomi, I'd like to once again thank you very much. We're really close to that witching hour, or half hour in our case, but I'd really like to thank you so much. Joining us tonight and highlighting what's necessary for people to get out there and do, let them know that the struggle's not over. So again, thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Tina and Deborah and Audrey. It was a lot of fun.
So before we sign off, I'd like to remind you that the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists meets on the second Tuesday of every month at 6 p.m. That's tomorrow night at 6025 East Burnside, Portland, and it is the William Lucy Building. We'd love to continue this conversation, so come on out and join us, and holla!
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Winter Blues Festival, Saturday, March 12th at the Elks Lodge and Ballroom, 13121 Southeast McLaughlin Boulevard in Milwaukee. Performing at this year's festival will be Candy Kane, Kara Granger, Robin Barrett, and Coyote Kings with Tiff Dames and more. The Winter Blues Festival is a benefit for the Oregon Food Bank and United by Music North America. It all happens on Saturday, March 12th at the Elks Lodge and Ballroom on McLaughlin in Milwaukee. Doors open at 2:30 and the music starts at 3. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Native Americans account for less than 2% of Oregon's population, yet we estimate over 10% of Native Americans are incarcerated in Oregon. I'm Trish Jordan of Red Lodge Transition Services. We began our work in Oregon prisons advocating for religious freedom and human rights. Join me on Prison Pipeline, March 14th, to hear how Red Lodge helps Native American women rebuild their lives after incarceration, often helping them reconnect to Native spirituality and culture. That's Prison Pipeline, March 14th at 6:30 p.m.
Good evening, greetings, and welcome to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. This evening, we are going to focus on a discussion surrounding a political prisoner by the name of Jalil Muntakim, who's been incarcerated for many years, since about 1970, when he was 19, related activity with the Black Panther Party and Black Liberation Army. Jalil is a writer and activist, and mentor and continues to be an organizer and advocate for human rights and civil rights and all those kind of things that we hold dear for this program and for the station and for humanity, period. And we are having an event for him on Thursday that you can also attend, and we'll talk about that more. But first, we are here with one of Jaleel's relatives. I should say we are on the phone, to be exact, with Blake. Blake, are you there?
Yeah, how you doing?
Hey, pretty good. Thanks for being on the program. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Blake, can you briefly talk about your relation to Jaleel and also just your own background and all the great work that you're doing?
Yeah, so Jaleel's my family member. I'm a student at UC Berkeley. I've been very active politically in the past year or so. I'm a part of the Black Student Union as well. I'm the Deputy Communications Director for the African Black Coalition, which is a coalition of Black student unions throughout the state of California. We actually recently forced the University of California system to divest $25 million from private prisons. I'm an organizer, I'm an activist, and I began speaking a lot about Jaleel's case and his need for the immediate freedom.
Blake, what do you want people to know specifically about Jaleel, his case, and kind of upcoming goings on here, like his next parole hearing?
Yeah, I want people first and foremost to know his next parole hearing, right? But also I want to know that tell people that he's a political prisoner, right? He's been in prison longer than Nelson Mandela after the whole COINTELPRO era, right, which was J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, which pretty much destroyed the Black Panther Party and the Black Power movement. So first and foremost, I want people to know that Jaleel is a political prisoner, right? And that his case is coming up for his freedom. To be paroled, right? And he was sentenced to 25 years, but he's been in for longer than that because of, his status as a political prisoner and how he's advocated for Black lives inside of prison.
Blake, can you talk about the work that's going on in your area that I'm sure you're probably initiating a lot of it too? Around Jaleel's case, what kind of things are being done to raise awareness around his case and also to advocate for his parole and amnesty?
So most recently, Oakland Jericho has been doing a lot of work around Jaleel's case, right? They had a celebration, a birthday celebration, as well as a fundraiser. Most recently, they've doing a CD of his poetry, because Jaleel's a poet. He has, beautiful poetry. That he also just published a book from prison, but recently they've been doing a fundraising for a CD of his poems, and the link is gogetfunding.com/startup for Oakland Jericho. So pretty much right now it's just like trying to uplift the consciousness of the people to know that, to know about his case, to know the facts about his case, and to know how he's been targeted specifically by the federal government. So that's a lot of the work we're doing right now, is trying to get the narrative of Jaleel, right? Because a lot of people don't know about political prisoners. They think about America like, oh, how can there be political prisoners in America when we know that it's true, right? So I think the biggest thing is political consciousness around his case and political education about what he's faced and what he's doing and about the circumstances that led up to his arrest and incarceration.
Mm-hmm. Blake, if I can ask it's somewhat of a personal question and maybe answer it in the way that you're comfortable with. But, here on Prison Pipeline in our program, that we do focus when we can, talking about how families are impacted by the prison industrial complex. And also this being a unique case, because we don't just have just any prisoner. We're talking about Jaleel, who's, long distance runner kind of. Activist and writer and artist and all these amazing things that he does. And if you can even if it's just brief, how does the family cope with his incarceration over these many, many years?
I can speak about, my personal experience. I can't really, speak for my whole family. But, for me, it's painful, to know he's been in prison for 45 years for standing for Black people. For standing for the liberation of humanity, right? And he's been incarcerated for 45 years since he was 19. So for me, it fuels me. It makes me very angry. That's right. Like, you read about COINTELPRO in history classes, you read about it, in the papers every once in a while, but it's also, like, personally affected me. and it's affected Jaleel, of course, right? So for me, it's painful. It makes me angry. But the way I'm able to feel my anger is by organizing and activism, right? So it's about, you know, reading what Jaleel is writing from, you know, inside of the prison, you know, and his recent book, Escaping the Prison, he wrote an essay that said, quote, divest from the PIC, prison industrial complex, to end mass incarceration. You know, so it's like I'm able to read his words from inside of prison and also put that into my organizing. So the biggest way I've been able to cope with it is through organizing around some of the issues that Jaleel was talking about for prison. And so, you know, for me, it was really special and it was very emotional, you know, when the organization I'm a part of, you know, forced the UC system to divest from private prisons. It was a very emotional, like, surreal moment for me because I'm like, you know, my uncle's talking about this from behind bars, you know, from apartheid Attica, as he would say. And to get that win, you know, very inspired me. And, you know, anytime I'm feeling kind of like down or upset or like, you know, things aren't going the right way, I just think about Jaleel. I think about, you know, I'm very lucky to be where I am and I got to, you know, pick up the torch where he left off and keep fighting.
And in your organizing, are you able to also connect with other family members of incarcerated persons and network that way?
Given, you know, the whole, you know, prison industrial complex and how it's targeting black lives, you know, a lot of us, you know, that I organize with have been personally affected by incarceration, you know, so a lot of us, you know, share that in our struggle. And one way we're able to, you know, move past our struggle and move onward is by organizing against a system that is oppressing us.
Can you talk about any updates on either Jaleel himself, how he's doing on the parole efforts, and or even just the book, talk about Fade to Black?
So the last, you know, we talk via letters, right? So, you know, it's not always the fastest process. But from the last I've heard from him, he's doing well, which is good. And he's always, you know, like he sent me an article to read, you know, so it's like, it's kind of cool. It's like he's almost mentoring me, like, in an intellectual way, too, through, you know, when we write letters to each other. He's like, hey, read this article, let me know what you think about it, you know? I think that's something that's been, you know, very powerful for me to do. What was the second part of that question?
Any updates on the parole efforts, kind of what that's looking like?
Right, right. So right now we have a petition out. So if you go to freejaleel.com, J-A-L-I-L.com, you can sign the petition, as well as the best thing you could do as well is just write a letter to the parole board. There's details on freejaleel.com about that. It's to send to, you want to send it to Tina Sanford. She's the chair of the New York Board of Parole. So we want people to send letters, you know, advocating for Jaleel. There's also a fact sheet about Jaleel and about what he's done, you know, in prison as well. So that can serve as like as a foundation for people to write about, right? Because Jaleel's done many amazing things from prison, right? You know, like one thing he started was a national prisoners newspaper, and that was actually the very first one, and he did that back in 1977. You know, so he's done a lot of great work from behind bars, and he's advocated for the community behind bars, and I think people should really focus on that when they write letters to the parole board. Like, he's not a threat to society, he's been a political prisoner.
So people should go to freejaleel.com for more details, getting copies of the petition that you can, there's ways of signing it online, and there's also ways of printing out PDFs. There is the trifold as well, as mentioned. So go to freejaleel.com and you can get all those materials. They will also be brought to this Thursday's event here in Portland at the Social Justice Action Center from 7 to 9 p.m. And that will be Fade to Black, a fundraiser and book release for Jaleel Muntakim. His new book, Fade to Black, has different writings, poetry, and what have you. On that bill will be people like Mike Crenshaw from KBOO Radio, Talilo from RLM Entertainment, Black Butterfly, Jamu Umi from the All African People's Revolutionary Party, Kent Ford, Chauncey Peltier, and a bunch of other folks will be speaking about political prisoners and different related issues to that, and also performing their different work. Walida Imarisha, who wrote one of the forewords for the book, will also be at the event as well. So we're really looking forward to all that. For anybody just tuning in, this is Prison Pipeline, and we're here with a family member, with Blake, who is related to Jaleel Muntakim, a long-term U.S.-held political prisoner. and we're having an event on Thursday, and we're also talking about the book and kind of local activism that's going on. So, Blake, can you talk more about some of the work that you – what I hear you saying is you've gotten really inspired to do more work around mass incarceration and against the prison industrial complex, and what kind of things do you see kind of ramping up in the next year around this kind of work?
Right, so, you know, ABC, the African Black Coalition, we just most recently forced the University of California to divest $25 million from the private prison industry. This was a, you know, a huge historic win for us, but, you know, we're keeping going right now as well. Our next target is Wells Fargo, because Wells Fargo is one of the primary financiers of the private prison industry. They have almost $1.3 billion credit line to private prisons, and they are a part of the Million Sheriff's Clubs in private prisons, right? And the UC system also invests $425 million into Wells Fargo. So we're saying if Wells Fargo doesn't divest from the private prison industry complex, we're going to force the UC system to divest $425 million out of private prison. So we're trying to inspire and help, you know, build this movement to divest from the prison industrial complex, which treats black bodies as numbers and dollar signs, just like, you know, how a slave auction would do. It's doing that through the mass incarceration system. So that's what our next movement is moving towards Wells Fargo, because these big banks that people are using, they're financing the incarceration of black and brown bodies. And anybody could invest in it, right? So you could go open, you could invest in the stock portfolios, and you could invest into the incarceration of black and brown people and get money from that, right? So we see this as one of this major moral and ethical problems in our society that needs to be fixed in order, you know, to end this era of mass incarceration that we are in.
Mm-hmm. And for Portland listeners who are, you know, interested in getting involved in work like that, obviously there might be, not be some of the same organizations in Portland than in the Bay Area, but can you talk about some of the groups in the Bay Area that you're working with and or coalitions and student groups and kind of what that looks like?
Yeah, so we work, so the African Black Coalition is a coalition of 16 black student unions throughout the UC system. The UC system is the largest educational system in the country, I believe. So, for instance, like we work with UC Berkeley's Black Student Union, we work with UC Santa Barbara's Black Student Union, we work with UCLA's Black Student Union. We also recently started our ABC school in West Oakland at the Ralph Bunche Academy, in which we're there once every 2 weeks, and we're, you know, teaching young black students how to organize in their community. So, you know, as we're doing this work against the mass incarceration system, we're also influencing and helping build the young generation, you know, kind of to lift as we climb, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned, you know, your correspondences with Jahlil and your inspiration, you know, from him to continue the work and ramp it up really. In that case, can you talk more about kind of the mentorship kind of in the movement and other ways you're also informed and inspired in your community?
Well, Jahlil has just inspired me just for everything he stood for throughout his whole life. He's never changed his beliefs, right? He's, even behind bars, he's still advocating for the same thing he was before he was behind bars, right? He stayed true to himself, he stayed true to his people, and he stayed true to humanity. So one of my major things, you know, mentorship has helped me, you know, become the man I am. So I want to be able to, you know, help the youth as well and be able to mentor different youth. And one way I do that is I'm a mentor in West Oakland, in which I help, you know, young boys and girls, you know, just kind of deal with the difficulties of the situations that they're living in and be able to tutor them and stuff like that. But yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about like kind of the facts of Jahlil's case too, because I think that's important to talk about as well.
Yeah. And, you know, you earlier mentioned very briefly, you know, FBI program under Hoover and COINTELPRO, and not everybody's totally up to speed on that, unfortunately. It's a piece of American history everybody should be aware of. But it includes the fact that it leads to the imprisonment of all these folks. In the U.S., we have probably at least, you know, about 100 U.S. held political prisoners, if not more, depending on which movements we're talking about, but definitely from kind of civil rights era, black liberation movement, Puerto Rican independence, American Indian movement. There are so many people still locked up under this, and there's been no redress for this case. So, yeah, if you can give a few more details about Jahlil for people who probably aren't familiar with him, which unfortunately it seems like Jahlil's case isn't out there as much. You know, people really hear about Mumia and Leonard Peltier a lot, and some of these other prisoners, people don't get to hear as much about their case.
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest things about Jahlil is that the first time they tried to imprison him, like, that it was found as a mistrial, I believe. And then the second case is when they actually convicted him, right? And basically the evidence that they used is they used a gun in his possession at the time of his arrest. But, you know, testimony of two women who knew the New York Three identified, like, uncertain witnesses to the crime, as well as the prosecution. They concealed the FBI ballistics report indicating that the gun found in Jahlil's position at the time of his arrest was actually not the same weapon that was used in the killings, right? So it was two different weapons, and the ballistics reports were never turned over to the defense team, which is unethical and is actually against the law. But, you know, because of who Jahlil was or who he is and who what he stands for, you know, he was still found guilty. Right, even though the ballistics reports didn't match, and even though the defense team did not get the ballistics report. So it just even just shows that right there, shows that he's a political prisoner. So it's pretty much they used false evidence on a weapon that he did not use, and they convicted him on murder for that charge. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very important for people to know the facts in that case, and also the time, the historical time period, right? George Jackson, I believe, was just assassinated right before Jahlil was arrested. Mm-hmm. So this was like at the very height of COINTELPRO, the height of, you know, the murder of Fred Hampton, right? And this was just another murder. It was just via the prison industrial complex and COINTELPRO. Mm-hmm. And since then, he's been locked behind bars at age 19. You know, and when I speak to, you know, a lot of peers my age, I'm like, you know, what were you doing at age 19, right? You know, here's a political prisoner who was fighting for you before you were even born, right? And we got to fight for our people who are behind bars and speak mm-hmm. for them.
Blake,
to help uplift their narrative. Yeah,
can you talk about his activism a little bit? Because I think one thing, too, that gets really messed up with these political prisoner cases is, as far as the really slanted, very, you know, neocon right, take on these cases is that it had nothing to do with you know, activism, that it was merely these wanton murders of police officers and yada yada yada. I mean, the thing goes on and on with the kind of disgusting narrative against what these people were actually for and what they were doing. So from Jahlil getting into the Panthers around, what was it, 16 or so, and then going Black Liberation Army, can you talk about what did that entail? What kind of work, what kind of activist work was actually going on for the community, for the Black community?
I mean, we could go on and on and on about the Black Panther Party's free, you know, programs that they did, right? And the free breakfast program is actually what started the FBI to start looking into them. So by, you know, the Black Panther Party feeding poor Black children was seen as the biggest threat to society, right? You know, you had the free clothing program. They had sickle cell. They had sickle cell testing. They had different medical clinics. They provided for the community, right? And that's something that the government did not do, right? So that's what the Black Panther Party rose out of. It rose out of oppression. It rose out of white supremacist oppression. And instead, it served, you know, with socialist views to serve the community, right? So that's what Jahlil was doing. He was also heavily, mm-hmm. you know, influenced by the death of Martin Luther King Jr., who was assassinated by the FBI, right? And, you know, there was a civil hearing, and the FBI was found guilty. So this is the same FBI that killed Martin Luther King is the same FBI that targeted Black activists, that targeted Black Panthers, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the Black Panther Party was seen as a threat because they said, you know, we have the right to self-defense. We have the right to declare our humanity. We have the right to declare, you know, to defend our humanity by any means necessary. And, you know, if Martin Luther King was a threat through nonviolence, then, of course, you know, the Black Panther Party would be seen as a threat, too.
Mm-hmm. And then from there, can you talk about activism, you know, again, before getting locked up and then kind of, you know, getting locked up and all the things that he's been doing in the last, I mean, gosh, going on almost 40 years now?
Yes, Jahlil, since his incarceration, he's always been active through his essays, through, you know, there's videos on YouTube of him speaking as well. But I think what amazes me and almost is, like, my favorite thing about his activism is some of his poetry. Mm-hmm. You know, his activism wasn't, what do you call it? It wasn't monolithic. Like, he did a variety of you know, variety of things. He was on the street as a, you know, as a Black Panther and as part of the BLA. And then he's also this world, he's a very, very intelligent person. You know, you could tell by his essays. His essays are very well thought out. They, you know, they provide a blueprint for what Black activists and Black organizers should be doing. And I think the most influential work is his words that he's written, and these words that, you know, came from inside of, you know, the belly of the beast and have came outside of it, you know, through his words that can serve as the blueprint for Black people to not only uplift their consciousness, but in, you know, his book, quote, we are our own liberators, right? It's a blueprint for Black activism.
Mm-hmm. And then now we have the recent Fade to Black book, which includes a lot of more recent writings and some pieces that, you know, he's, I think, you know, updated and things that he puts out on the blog as well. So because of the internet, we can say at least it allows his prolific work to be prolific as far as the way that it's being put out, because people are, you know, quick to, we get a copy and type it up and get it on the blog real quick. So it's great, you know, and it's interesting how when you talk about Jahlil and being kind of the scholar that he is, you know, he would probably have a couple of doctorates at this point, but because he's been in New York State, you know, they cut a lot of the money for the Pell Grants and stuff to go on for higher education. So, you know, when we talk about the political prisoners, right, you know, there's so many of these related issues, you know, him being in New York. Blake, I'm not sure how much experience you had with him on the phone back in the day when, you know, a lot of New York prison activists were fighting against MCI and stuff for all their really high fees to get in touch with the prisoners. And that was all, you know, kind of like its own divestment campaign or what have you. You know, fast forwarding, though, with Jahlil's incarceration going up to about 2007, there was also the San Francisco 8 case, too. And I don't know how familiar you are with the San Francisco 8 case, if you want to say anything about that, when he got extradited to San Francisco in 2007.
Right. I'm not particularly as versed on that. Yeah, I don't know as much of the details as I do about the New York 3 case, but I just remember him being extradited for the San Francisco 8. I'm not sure what they ruled for that, but I know, like, specifically there's a reason why they keep him in New York. It's because our family isn't in New York, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one way they specifically try and isolate him from our family, right? Because it's, you know, traveling is not cheap, and it's not easy to get to New York. You know,
so absolutely.
That's one thing that they have done, you know, on purpose.
Right. And, you know, when he got moved to Attica, which he's had a real rough time at Attica since he's been there for the last couple of years now. It hasn't really gotten much of a better, you know, conditions there that he's experienced. And before he was in Auburn, New York, which isn't that far away. And that's actually one of America's, you know, first, you know, big prisons in upstate New York was in Auburn. Right down the road, actually, ironically, from where Harriet Tubman had settled down later in her life, you know, with the Underground Railroad. So she was right down the street from this old, well, it wasn't an old prison at that time, obviously, but now Auburn's very old prison. And so Jahlil got moved when David Gilbert, who's another political prisoner, got moved there. So when you talk about the switching around and the harassment, it creates a lot of instability for everybody.
Right. As well as, you know, just trauma, too, mm-hmm. you know, for the families. Like, it keeps being moved and moved around, and that always, you know, brings more and more hardships on the family, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's another important thing to note.
Absolutely.
But it's a beast of the system. It's meant to dehumanize people. It's, you know, it's inhumane. You know, personally, I'm a prison abolitionist. I believe that, you know, mass incarceration system is a system of new slavery. You know, what Jahlil talked about in this book, and, you know, citing, you know, Ruffin versus the state of Virginia. Like, it literally says slave, right? And this mm-hmm. is where I first learned about it. I didn't learn about it from a professor. You know, I got to go, quote unquote, UC Berkeley, which is the number one public institution in the world. But I'm learning about, you know, Ruffin versus Virginia from my uncle Jahlil Martin King, and he's behind bars, you know?
Right.
So I think we have this, like, I mean, it comes out of white supremacist ideals that, you know, the most, you know, academic people are in universities, but Jahlil, you know, his work in his academia is, you know, is much more truth-telling than a lot of these, you know, academic journals. So I think that's what one thing I want people to know is that this man is a, you know, he's a beautiful man, and intellectually he's a beautiful man, too, and so people need to read what's coming out of prisons, right? Mm-hmm. Read what's coming out of the belly of the beast, especially in this era of Black Lives Matter. We have people who are saying Black Lives Matter before the phrase existed through their actions to the Black Panther Party and have, you know, been incarcerated, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, with the recent release of Albert, who was a part of the Angola 3, I believe, you know, it's giving me a lot more hope about Jaleel's case coming up. But, you know, especially with the whole Beyonce, you know, what happened with Beyonce and, you know, her political stance she made, I don't know if people realize, but there was, you know, a counter-reaction.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it was a protest planned, right, to, you know, protest Beyonce, who was, you know, talking about the Black Panther Party, who paid tribute, paid homage, right? And the images that they used were Jaleel's.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Wow. I don't see that as no coincidence. They used Jaleel's image, they used Herman Bell's image, you know, in that article, too, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, as the Black Panther Party, as the Black Panthers were on the big stage, you know, you still have Black Panthers in the pen as well. So it's like, we need to advocate, you know, not only for the Black Panther aesthetic, but also the people of the Black Panther Party. We kind of forget about the people who are still under the belly of the beast.
Right. The way that Jaleel embodies the Black Lives Matter movement in a sense, you know, and he's been definitely talking about it quite a bit. So, Blake, we got to wrap it up. And can you just briefly mention again how to, you know, get in touch, learn about Jaleel's case, download the petition or what have you?
Yeah, so the best thing you can do is go to freejaleel.com. On the home website, you know, there's a link. The very first link is goes to this parole campaign. So the best thing you could do is sign the petition, sign the hard version of the petition as well, and also write a letter to the parole board, you know, demanding the release of Jaleel Luther King. And I think it's very important to read the facts about his case and to use the facts in the letters that you're going to write, right? As well as the historical, you know, connotations of what was going on during the time of his targeted incarceration.
Right.
So yeah, the best thing you can go do is go to freejaleel.com. That's the best way to stay updated. As well as, you know, good things you could do is hold, you know, fundraisers for Jaleel, hold, you know, book openings, celebrations for Jaleel, in which the money could go back to Jaleel and helping him fight his case and ultimately be a free Black man.
Right on. And we have that happening here in Portland this Thursday. So please be there at the Social Justice Action Center between 7 and 9 p.m. Social Justice Action Center is right off of Southeast 12th and Stark. Social Justice Action Center, this event will be featuring the new book from Jaleel. There'll be some copies for sale. And again, Mike Crenshaw from our station will be there performing and speaking, and Walida and Marisha, Ajamu Umi. The list goes on of the local talent and people that are participating in this event, which is really important to help raise money for his parole. Come get a copy of the book. Like Blake's talking about, learn about the case, learn about the history of COINTELPRO, U.S. held political prisoners. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 97.FM. Excuse me. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Want to thank our guest, Blake. Blake, looking forward to hearing from you again. Maybe we got to get you on to talk about more of the prison divestment stuff. Hopefully, maybe next time we're on, Jaleel will already be out, right?
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah, hopefully, God willing.
All right. Thanks so much. And thanks to our engineer, Michael. Have a great evening. Free them all, and we'll see you next week.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Heathers, the musical, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from March 10th through April 2nd at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Based on the classic 1989 film, Westerberg High is ruled by a shoulder-padded, scrunchie-wearing junta, Heather, Heather, and Heather, the hottest and cruelest girls in all of Ohio. But misfit Veronica Sawyer rejects their evil regime for a new boyfriend, the dark and sexy stranger JD, who plans to put the Heathers in their place, 6 feet under. Again, that's Heathers the Musical, March 10th through April 2nd at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Things will get better soon.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Smoldering Fires, produced by Passenart. The play runs from March 11th through April 10th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center in Portland. Smoldering Fires explores how to apply the ideas and struggles of the civil rights movement to contemporary city life through the point of view of two young friends who differ in temperament and approach. Again, that's Smoldering Fires, March 11th through April 10th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, 5340 Northeast Interstate Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Native Americans account for less than 2% of Oregon's population, yet we estimate over 10% of Native Americans are incarcerated in Oregon. I'm Trish Jordan of Red Lodge Transition Services. We began our work in Oregon prisons advocating for religious freedom and human rights. Join me on Prison Pipeline, March 14th, to hear how Red Lodge helps Native American women rebuild their lives after incarceration, often helping them reconnect to Native spirituality and culture. That's Prison Pipeline, March 14th at 6:30 p.m.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Hard Knock Radio, so stay tuned.
This is Danny Glover, and I want you to listen to what I listen to, Hard Knock Radio.
Yo, this ain't your boy, this your brother, Ice Life.
And this M1 International, RBG all day, baby.
On Hard Knock Radio.
Word up.
Check it out, yo.
Can I be the one to bring you joy?
What's up, y'all? This is Lettucey with Hard Knock Radio.
News, views, and hip-hop. I, man, is Winston Bradney, a.k.a. Burning Spear, on Hard Knock Radio. Jai's real.
Things and stuff and stuff and things and stuff. Grieve me. I'm a bold soul sister.
Thank you. KVD Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. And on today's show, we want to bring attention to some of the many trials that are taking place around the country regarding members that are associated with or actually a part of the Black Lives Matter movement. There have been a number of trials because over the past year or so, people have done everything from direct action campaigns where traffic has been stopped or city officials have been visited directly at their homes, or things have been trumped up based upon the dislike that those who have been targeted, including the police, have levied on Black Lives Matter members. One of the big trials is starting in Los Angeles, and that is one of the more larger and more vibrant and organizations within the BLM movement. I wanted to talk to Nani Jumfrey. She is the attorney for the folks that are down with the Black Lives Matter movement in LA, and kind of get an update as to what is going on and what's happening and why this is important for us to spend, to pay attention to these ongoing trials. So, Nana, thank you very much for being on the show with us. Why don't we just kind of give people a little bit of 101 Black Lives Matter movement and some of the trials that are taking place in particular in Los Angeles?
Thank you so very much, David D., for having me on. I really appreciate it. We are fighting cases that date as far back as November of 2014, even though the work of Black Lives Matter here in Los Angeles, of course, precedes that. Black Lives Matter in general, the general network, actually really found its seeds here in Los Angeles after the Trayvon Martin case, where George Zimmerman was acquitted of the murder of Trayvon Martin. There were people who were, of course, upset, who joined in the community in protests and demonstrations, and then sat back and said, hey, what can we do that is more proactive? And that's where the seeds of the Black Lives Matter movement began. And so the organization in Los Angeles is one of the more dynamic organizations in terms of work. You know, there's constant work on a weekly basis that's being done in terms of the movement for Black lives here in Los Angeles, in the greater Los Angeles area, and really state and nationwide. The cases that we have are coming out of different situations, different demonstrations that occurred. We just got and completed two cases that were combined into one that came out of two Black Lives Matter movement members simply trying to meet with the mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, who alleges he's a progressive and walked with Obama and all of those things that they say, who was at a public event, and these two Black Lives Matter members attempted to speak with him. As a result of their attempt to speak with him, they ended up being charged with trespassing, resisting, obstructing and delaying a peace officer in their duties, and battery on a police officer, as well as battery causing injury on a peace officer. By the time the trial was over, they had eight witnesses that were presented by the prosecution. They had four and five different stories, and these are from cops, about what had happened. Chief Beck, we had gotten a bench warrant and body attachment on him for his failure to appear at the trial as a percipient witness. And we clearly were able to expose that really what this was about was that the mayor and the police chief here, Charlie Beck, were afraid of and didn't want to be bothered with Black Lives Matter members, not because of any physical fear on their part, but they just understood that they represent and are able to expose the hypocrisy of this so-called progressive city that has the most murderous police force in the country, that has the most attacking of BLM protesters or affiliates in the country, and they didn't want that hypocrisy to be exposed in this public way. And so after, go ahead.
Go ahead, finish your point.
After dealing with that case, we are now, there's another case that was levied against one of those same BLM protesters, literally for walking down a hallway in LAPD headquarters that was a public hallway. The city attorney at the last minute on the day of trial dismissed that case. And so now on Monday, we're facing our third case. This is all within a four-week period. We're facing our third trial, which is the trial of the Black Lives Matter LA 7, who are accused of resisting or refusing, the order of a peace officer and obstructing a public street for their disruption on the 101 freeway November 26, 2014, as part of the nationwide protests and disruptions that were going on after the non-indictment of Darren Wilson.
One of the things, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, is twofold. One, we knew and we understand that historically a tactic to disrupt protests that, especially those coming out of the Black community that are challenging the police, have resulted in, as a counter strategy, an attempt to put people in trial. We saw that play out with the Black Panthers, who, you know, who found themselves constantly in court, in and out of court, with the goal of depleting resources and redirecting their movement to having to defend themselves on charges versus really dealing with the issues at hand that, caused these organizations to form in the first place, which is police brutality slash terrorism. The other thing that comes to mind is just seeing how the new laws that are in place, gang injunctions, laws around terror, conspiracy laws. I think there was a member of the BLM who was associated with a gang at one point, and they wanted to try and make the connection years down the road and put some charges around that. So I wanted to make sure that people were aware that there's a sophistication and there is a reaching or grand net that they are often using to try and charge people. And maybe you could speak to that, as well as just the tactic of trying to tie up resources and energies in court cases.
Definitely. I mean, we expected that just based upon history and the history that you've pointed out, that there would be these attempts by the state to have folks criminalized. First of all, to criminalize the movement, which is what they did with the Black Panther Party and even with the civil rights movement, the more liberal sort of moderate civil rights movement. There was an attempt to criminalize it, to make it so that you wouldn't send your son out there. You wouldn't let your daughter go out there because you're going to be arrested, right? You're going to be associated with these criminals. And then that continued and was even more amplified when we're talking about the Black Power movement, and we see that return here. There's a that's part of what the purpose of charging people is, to make it appear to the general public that no, these are not people who are just engaged in peaceful demonstration. These are people who are lawbreakers. These are people who are criminals. And since Black folks in this country are already associated with criminality, those two things go hand in hand, it's not a huge jump to go from the Black protester or protector, as I like to say, the Black demonstrator, as now becoming, you know, that criminal, even though they claim that they're doing it for the good. And so as the city attorney said in his closing arguments in the case we just did, you know, they are doing something, but they're doing it the wrong way. They're doing it in a criminal way. And that is sort of the resound that they want to have out there with the charges. Then secondly, yes, to tie up resources, to try to make it so that instead of the organizations doing the work, because the work is effective, and it's not effective, they don't harass you. The work is effective. And so as a counter to the effective work, there's this effort through charging folks to try to break the back of the movement in that way. Break the back of the movement by resources, break the back of the movement in terms of sort of dirtying up the goodwill of the movement and the reputation of the movement, and to break the back of the movement by trying to attack the spirit of the movement, the spirit of those individuals who are engaged in this direct action, this confrontational action. And so the charges and the taking these cases to trial is meant to do that as well. What we have done in Black in LA is to really make a point of not allowing that to happen, to continue doing the work that we're doing, to support the legal cases as much as folks can in terms of the organizing folks, but to not allow the eyes to be so taken off of the organizing that that doesn't happen because you're focused about, you know, around these cases and trying to deal with those. And then, go ahead.
Well, question that I have, and I think many that are listening, first of all, we have attorney Nani Jumfrey on the phone with us. She is the attorney for the Black Lives Matter LA folks who are dealing with trials starting today. There are many that are listening, and they're saying, well, you know, maybe you shouldn't block traffic on the freeway. Maybe you shouldn't do direct action because the state has adjusted to those tactics and they are going to try and put people in jail and arrest them. And why have good people go to jail? Why have people, hard-earned money go towards defense and all that other stuff? And the question that gets raised sometimes is, why not try another way? And even though I know you don't want to quote the clothing attorney or the mayor, is like, well, you know, can't you do it another way? Can't you find another way to protest where you won't be breaking the law? How do you respond to that, one? And two, would they be finding other ways in which to criminalize you even if you did it by the book, so to speak? And I guess let me just add another thing. How does your tactic compare to, say, tactics that were used by, say, folks like the Ruckus Society, who specialized in direct action and did that often, or somebody like Code Pink, who were, you know, famous for running up on presidents and in the halls of Congress and quote-unquote trespassing but disrupting and getting their point across? You know, did they find themselves on trial as much as you're seeing BLM members?
Okay, let me see how we can answer all of those.
We got 15 questions and you got 10 seconds.
I think the first two questions, go together. Firstly, there are many different ways that Black Lives Matter Los Angeles does the work that it does. So all of the work is not direct action work. That's the first thing. Secondly, what we have found is that the most effective work has been the direct action work, the work that has actually resulted in something. You know, in Los Angeles, we will every 20 years have a big old kicking up dust rebellion. And people say, well, why do you do that? Well, you know what? That's when things happen. That's when things happen, when people are politicking and trying to lobby and doing those other types of activities that do not disrupt business as usual. We tend to not get things done. In Los Angeles, when Black folks kick up dust and do not allow business to go as usual, suddenly there are programs, there is money, there is funding, there are policy changes, all kinds of things happen. And so I think that there's some kind of myth that you can quietly, silently, you know, stand in a circle and, you know, meditate and levitate upon things happening. And that history has just shown that that's not the case, that things happen because people put themselves and put their bodies on the line. And that's when things occur. So that's the first, you know, my response to the first two. When you look at the tactics and how the response is different, I would tell people, when you look at Occupy and the way that Occupy was dealt with, that's not that long ago. Here in Los Angeles, Occupy was mainly white. So white that the Black folks and the brown folks in Southeast Asia had to form their own Occupy called Occupy the Hood. Okay.
Right.
So Occupy LA was different than Occupy the Hood, right? And the way that Occupy folks were treated worked much, much less harshly. People, they were treated more sort of like the anti-apartheid people during my time, right? Where we would go, people, you'd get arrested, and then you know, they may write you up a ticket, they may not, you may stay there for a minute, they let you out OR and move on. In this situation, it is much more what they do when they are targeting a movement that they consider to be one composed of Black folks, right? And when they see it as one that's composed of Black folks that is fighting specifically for Black people in this country, suddenly what Arabs do in the Arab Spring and what's happening in Ukraine, what everyone else can do in the United States law is freedom fighting and all these demonstrators are wonderful and great and fabulous, much less happening here by Black people on behalf of Black lives is considered to be terrorism, right? And so we have to push back against this notion that somehow Black people are the only people in this country who are not allowed to fight for our lives or to stand up for our lives.
Let me just interrupt for a second, because you used the word terrorism, and I think some people would say, oh, that's exaggeration, but the word terrorism in the Black Lives Matter movement Those two words have been tossed together on more than a few occasions by police unions in New York City and in L.A. where people have tried to find laws to connect that. Am I right or wrong on that? I just want to make sure that people are clear.
You are absolutely right. First of all, we have, in one of our Black Lives Matter cases that is coming out of Pasadena, we have a sister charged with terrorist threats. Okay? So that connection has been made right there. Terrorist threats. Basically for being, you know, speaking and talking as part of a protest on behalf of Kendrick McDade, who was killed by the Pasadena Police Department, unarmed brother. Turns out it was a lie that he was even accused of, and they didn't follow policy. They killed him, right?
Somebody called now, up and accused him of doing something for people who don't
exactly.
know. And it was a false charge, and the police shot him anyway.
And the police shot him anyway. That person's been charged with perjury and everything, right? But the police shot him anyway. And then we look at the jury selection that I just completed for this last trial. When I'm asking folks, how do you feel about Black Lives Matter? And people are raising their hand. These are average working class folks that happen to be at this particular courthouse and saying, well, you know, I don't mind when people want to express their speech and if they want to protest. But when protesters kill people, that's when they've gone too far. And I'm like, really? What Black Lives Matter protesters have killed people? When did this happen? And I had to literally go through sort of like a brief, because you can't really talk that much during jury selection, a brief layout for folks to understand that, no, Black Lives Matter folks are not terrorists, because that's what these folks think. Many of them, not one or two. You know, it's kind of like the Trump people, how people try to act like it was only three people. Now they're finding out it's millions. Okay, it's the same thing. This is not the thoughts of just two or three people. There are millions of people out here who are associating Black Lives Matter and the Black Lives Matter movement with some kind of anti-police, anti-system, anti-white people terrorism that must be stopped. And you can't help but think about the Black Panther Party and the way that the Black Panther Party was vilified in that same kind of way, right? A party that actually was very internationalist, revolutionary, that connected with folks, you know, across race, across gender, etc. But the thought when you say Black Panther Party is, oh, that's the group that, you know, with the terrorist organization that was anti-white, anti-cop, and anti-system, you know, anti-government. And so we see that coming back now again with the Black Lives Matter movement without any images of folks walking around with rifles and berets or anything else, just from the fact that they are speaking on behalf of black lives and that they are black people.
What's crazy about that is that if you look at critique of the BLM movement from what people would consider the radical left in the black community, the Black Lives Matter movement is accused of not being militant enough. It's accused it's often been stated, you know, from people that we've even had on our shows, like the Bruce Dixons and Black Agenda Report folks and others have said that, you know, the BLM movement is a bougie movement. It's not very hardcore. It needs to go a lot deeper. It needs to be more strident in its methods. And, you know, and you know, there's a lot of debate about that. But then when you look at what's happening, is like it's all these BLM folks being brought up on charges all over the place, which begs the question, you know, well, if they are really connected to the Hillary Clintons and some sort of machine, where's that machine to get them out of jail? Because people are being convicted and people are tied up in those court cases. And it's very counter to what the police have put out about the BLM movement, which is what you said, is a criminal terrorist organization. So it's like you can't win for losing.
Can't win for losing. It really is like that. I mean, one of the things that we are pushing, and we push with this case that is coming up with the freeway stoppage with other cases, is that, hey, you have people that say they honor King. You have people that say they honor Parks. They honor the Freedom Riders. They honor Fannie Lou Hamer in progressive cities like the Los Angeles is supposed to be, right? A progressive mayor and a progressive city attorney. And yet, they're prosecuting Black Lives Matter members for literally doing exactly what King and the civil rights movement folks did. I mean, if folks would go and review the film of real life footage, it was not a sidewalk movement. When you see the dogs attacking people and the hoses, people are walking in the street. Those streets are closed while those people are doing that.
Without a permit. you know,
without a permit.
Right.
You know, we're talking about Selma. We're supposed to be rooting for the protesters, right? That they are able to get across this bridge, that they are crossing without a permit. But somehow now that's some kind of terrorist organizational work by the same people who every January 15th and, you know, and all through Black History Month are talking about how much they honor the legacy of the civil rights movement. It's hypocritical, but it's allowed to proceed because the connection, you know, there is no love lost between the white progressive, the white liberal folks and Black people. I mean, they're not concerned about Black people in the way that they claim to be concerned about Black people, so they're not coming to the rescue. If there's any place that would happen, it would be L.A., and it's not happened.
Let me ask you this as you close out. People that are listening around the country, what are two or three things they should take away from this conversation as to what is going on in L.A.? Why is this going to be relevant to, say, folks who are listening in Atlanta or Seattle or here in the Bay or in Washington, D.C., where there are vibrant BLM chapters? Why should this be of concern right now?
Well, what they should be concerned about is keeping the connection with the community in such a way that the system is not able to criminalize, that the system is not able to demoralize, that the system is not able to delegitimize the Black Lives Matter movement, because that's what this really is about. The efforts that LA is engaged in, their hope is that as people go to trial and that as people are convicted, that will take the wind out of the sails, right? That the community will say, oh, well, you know, when you do these things, all that happens is that you're going to end up with some kind of misdemeanor charge or some kind of felony charge, or that, you know, these people are criminals anyway. And so it's really important. I think we need to really ratchet up the work that we're doing to be able to tell our narrative and to put our narrative out there, to put, you know, the truth out there about what it is that we're doing, to connect ourselves to the various movements that Black people have been engaged in since we, you know, since before we were dragged over here to fight back against white supremacy and to fight for Black lives. That it's important for us to stand up and to understand that the winning is the fighting. You know, I say all the time, the saying is you cannot fight City Hall. Not you can't beat City Hall. Not you can't whoop City Hall or win, but that you can't even fight City Hall, right? And so we have to make it clear that, no, we will engage the state. We will fight the state, and that we will stand up. And if that means that we have to do court cases,